And now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press, America's press conference of the air. Ready for this afternoon's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. Now meet Mr. Alastair Cook of the Manchester Guardian of England. Dr. Ruth Alexander of the New York Mirror. Mr. James Rustin of the New York Times. Mr. Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine. Finally, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, Lord Russell and members of our press panel. Now, Lord Russell, if you're ready, we'll let Mr. Lindley have the first question.
Lord Russell, how do you expect to see the conflict between the communist world and the free world resolved? By war or by what means?
Well, I should hope, of course, that it will be resolved without war. But on the whole, I don't expect that. I get, as time goes on, rather more despairing about avoiding war. But I still hope that it may be avoided.
Do you think that free men can feel safe or really be safe so long as so much of the world is held in the grip of the Soviet police state?
Yes, I do, most emphatically. If the Soviet police state were persuaded that world conquest was impossible, and that can be done simply by rearmament in the West, if it were persuaded of that, then we could live quite peaceably, let them have what they like, and we have what we like.
You feel, then, that the free world is on the right track in building up its armaments?
I do, most emphatically. I think it's the only thing to do.
Dr. Alexander.
Lord Russell, do you feel that now Churchill has come in that he will withdraw recognition of the Chinese communists in view of the statement you've just made that we cannot really get along with Russia in the long run?
No, I think it's extremely unlikely. I think altogether Churchill is going to prove a disappointment to America.
Really? Mr. Rustin.
Lord Russell, have your ideas not changed considerably in the last 25 years as to the ways in which peace may be maintained in the world?
Well, I suppose in the course of 25 years one is capable of learning something, and I've found both Hitler and Stalin very useful instructors. I think both of them have taught me things that I didn't know before. But I should be ashamed if I was not capable of learning from experience.
Mr. Rustin, are you trying to say that Lord Russell was at one time one of our leading pacifists and has since changed his mind?
Well, I was suggesting that, yes.
Well, I don't think we had such bad enemies then as we have had since 1933. And so I think it was possible to take a pacifist line then, and it's not possible now. I never took an absolute pacifist line. I always took the view that some wars are justifiable and others not.
When did you give up your pacifistic views, Lord Russell? Weren't you a pacifist in 1917? When did you change?
Oh, I haven't changed at all, except in a practical sense. That's to say, the principles upon which I decided whether a war is justifiable or not were exactly the same during the First War as they are now. I thought the First War was not justifiable. I thought the Second was. And the third, whether that will be or not, depends upon how it comes about. But that was no change of principle. It was merely a change in the circumstances.
Well, I thought a pacifist always felt that no war was justified,
yes,
regardless.
I was never a pacifist in that sense, never. In fact, in 1914, after the war had begun, I published an article in the International Journal of Ethics setting out four kinds of wars that I thought justifiable.
You were just a limited pacifist.
Yes. Yeah.
Mr. Cook.
Lord Russell, what did you mean by saying that Americans might be disappointed in Mr. Churchill?
Well, I think they imagine that he's going to undo a lot of things that the Labour Party did. And I think the only thing he will undo is the iron and steel, nationalisation of iron and steel. As for the rest, I think he'll leave things pretty much as they were.
Are you suggesting that it's pretty difficult to undo anything socialists have done, Lord Russell?
Well, I don't know whether it's difficult or not, but I don't believe he would really wish to.
Mr. Rustin.
Lord Russell, 3 years ago there were three socialist governments in the British Commonwealth. Today there are none. I wonder if that, in your judgment, is merely a coincidence or whether you believe that the socialist force or appeal to the world is perhaps now less than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, I don't see any evidence of that at all. The change in the vote in England has been extremely small. Even in this last election, the Labour Party had a majority of votes. And in Australia, there were various special circumstances. I don't see any reason to think it's more than the usual swing of the pendulum. I think presently it'll swing the other way.
Dr. Alexander.
What proportion of the victory of Churchill would you attribute to domestic discontent, and what proportion discontent with the handling of foreign affairs?
Well, it's extremely difficult to say, but I think more to domestic affairs, probably, because as regards foreign affairs, while a great many people felt that the Middle East was being very badly handled, a great many other people felt, well, thank God we've kept out of war.
Mr. Lindley.
Lord Russell, you've visited the United States at intervals over a good many years. I believe the first time 55 years ago or more. During that period, what are the most significant changes you've seen in the American scene, apart from our industrial growth, perhaps, which would be obvious?
Well, that's a very large question. I'm not sure whether I can answer it offhand, but, of course, the most important change is that you now are the leading world power, and that necessarily involves a very considerable change in people's outlook on all sorts of questions. There wasn't the same consciousness of the world at large 55 years ago.
Do you think we're doing a fairly good job in our new role as a world leader or not? What are our main deficiencies if we're not doing a good job?
I think you're doing a fairly good job, a better job than one could expect with so little experience. On the whole, I think it's satisfactory, though not wholly.
Lord Russell, are you still a socialist?
Oh, yes.
How do you reconcile your love of freedom with your belief in socialism?
Well, I think they go together. I think any lover of freedom must be a socialist. I don't think you can desire freedom for the wage earner unless you are a socialist. The lovers of freedom that I meet in this country mean freedom for the capitalist, and that is a very limited form of freedom. But if you want largely distributed freedom, you have to be a socialist.
Well, now, if you're going to guarantee work, you're going to guarantee security to a man, how will you get those to work who don't want to work, without forcing them to work?
Well, you will have to force them to some degree, undoubtedly. I mean,
you think that's freedom?
Yes, I think it always has been. I mean, you say, do I think that's freedom? You don't propose that in this country a man should be paid the same wages whether he works or whether he doesn't. And you don't say, what a lack of freedom in America, because we don't do that.
No, but we say that each man is free to go as far as he can.
Well, so do we. He's free to go to work, or free, if he likes to starve, he cannot work. But obviously, you can't expect to be supported by the community if you don't do anything for it.
But under socialism, will there be a right to starve? Oh. Or will it be a crime against the state?
To starve?
To starve or not to work.
Oh, I don't suppose it would be a crime against the state, because it would hardly need to be.
No, but I mean, aren't you force men to work who don't want to work under a socialistic state?
Well, not nearly as much as you do under the existing state. You see, you always think, you people who uphold the capitalist system, that if a man is forced to do a thing by the capitalist, that is compatible with liberty. But if he's forced to do it by the state, it is not. And that is absurd.
Mr. Ruskin?
Lord Russell, if we are to go through an entire generation of armed, perhaps Cold War, not direct armed conflict, but of certainly mobilization. What is going to happen to the reflective life of individuals in such an atmosphere of Cold War as at the present time?
Well, I think the effect will be very disastrous indeed. I think the general level of civilization will be lowered, though not so much as it would be by a war. But still, I think it will be lowered quite a lot.
Is there any way in which we can minimize the effect of the Cold War on the individual, in your judgment?
Not very easily, I think, except by realizing that if, as you state, you stand for liberty, it would be a good plan to have a little liberty.
Mr. Cook.
Are you suggesting, Lord Russell, that there's less liberty in the United States than in Great Britain, say?
Oh, infinitely less. Incomparably less.
In which ways?
Well, in every kind of way. Liberty of opinion. In England, an avowed communist can hold a university post. Nobody suffers for his opinions as he does in this country. People don't look behind doors before they tell you what they think about politics. No, it's a totally different atmosphere in England.
You're not suggesting that the doors are wired, are you?
You're not suggesting that people look behind doors here before they express an opinion, Lord?
I am, rather, yes. I've...
What doors have you been behind where you've seen them?
Well, I don't know that that's perhaps a picturesque way of putting it, but I do find extreme caution in a great many people in expressing their political opinions.
Lord Russell, in an article you did recently, you said, and I quote, "For the salvation not only of our own nation, it is necessary that Britain and America should become conscious more and more of each other's merit than of each other's faults." Now, the article, however, dealt only with our faults, as you are here doing today. What are some of our merits?
Well, will you pardon me? I think you're alluding to an article in Look.
Yes, sir.
Well, now, I think I must here state what is important. I called that article, "What is wrong with Anglo-American relations?" And Look, without consulting me or letting me know, changed the title to "What is wrong with Americans?" And that was not done with my consent. And the article, in the form in which I wrote it, said a very great deal about English faults. And I think English faults are at least as bad as yours.
But not many things about America's merits.
Oh, yes, there are a lot of things about America's merits. But you will find whenever you write an article about any country containing both praise and blame, the people in that country notice only the blame and don't notice the praise because that seems to them commonplace.
Lord Russell, I read the article very carefully last night and I noticed only the blame. I found none of
yes,
the praise.
Yes, you would. You would notice only the blame. That's what I'm saying.
You said, for example, that American theory is dedicated to democratic equality, but in practice is dedicated to plutocratic inequality. Is that praise or blame?
Oh, that, I think, is blame, but you would have found other things that were praise.
In America, as in Russia, there is a tendency to attribute everything to a compatriot and ignore what is done by others. Is that praise or blame?
That's blame, too, I agree. I mean, I agree there were things that were blame, but there were also things that were praise.
I cannot think of any American who contributed anything of importance at this stage to the development of atomic energy. Was that praise or was that blame?
Well, that, I suppose, also was blame, but you've picked out the things that were blame.
Mr. Cook.
Lord Russell, would you tell us, looking back over the 55 years that you've been traveling across the Atlantic, what are the changes that you notice in anti-Americanism in Britain? In other words, who is anti-American today? Who used to be anti-American?
Oh, yes, it's a complete turnover. In old days, it was the Tories who disliked America because America was the champion of democracy and they hated democracy. Now, it's the left-wing socialists, not the whole of the socialists, but the left-wing socialists who dislike America because it's the bulwark of capitalism. So that it's now the extreme radicals who dislike America, whereas formerly it was the extreme reactionaries.
Mr. Reston.
Lord Russell, with your views on the necessity of freedom for the development of a state, what is your view as to what is going to happen in Russia where freedom is so restricted as it is today?
Well, I think Russia will go down and down. I think Russia will become even technically inefficient as a result of lack of freedom. I think if you can hold off war long enough, the Russians will, for lack of freedom, become so inefficient that their war machine won't be any good.
How long is long enough, Lord Russell?
20 years.
20 years.
Dr. Alexander.
Well, back to that question of freedom under socialism. I believe the socialist states are committed to a planned economy, and under a planned economy, no one has the right to disagree with the plan. He can't be a nonconformist. So how can you say that a socialist state, such as you've just had in Britain, has more freedom than we have in this country?
Well, look, you have a completely different economic setup in England from what you have in this country. If we had free enterprise in England, It would mean that the bulk of the population would starve. You know that in a beleaguered fortress you have to ration food. England is a beleaguered fortress. And you cannot have the sort of freedom in England, in that respect, that you can have in this country. And I maintain that the freedom to have enough to eat for the whole population is more important than the freedom to make large profits for a tiny minority.
But isn't private enterprise the only way that enough goods and services can be produced so that they don't have to be rationed because of scarcity?
Oh, dear me, no, not at all, nothing of the sort. If we'd had the Tories in power during these last years, we should have been worse off than we are at present.
Lord Mr. Russell, Henry. As you travel about the United States, you think the American workman is downtrodden and impoverished under our
certainly
capitalist
not.
System?
Certainly not. Having you in America, you're the world's plutocrats, not only the capitalists among you, but the working men, too. I mean, the whole world contributes to your welfare. And, of course, it's a grand situation, but we're not in that fortunate position we used to be.
Yeah, well, that brings up the question of the future of Britain. Do you think Britain can really recover to any great degree economically, or can it remain the center and head of an empire and commonwealth?
Well, I think we ought enormously to diminish the population, because I think this business of importing food is too difficult nowadays. And I should like to see the population very much diminished by immigration.
Lord Russell, you said a moment ago that you think that the Great Britain would have been worse off under the Conservatives than they were under the Labour government.
Yes.
Could they have been much worse off?
Oh, indeed, yes. Why, you know, the things that Americans say about our condition in England are simply, utterly, and absolutely fantastic.
We say you're in bad financial condition. Is that
fantastic?
Well,
that, of course, the finance is true. But when it comes to the question of food, I mean, I'm always meeting Americans who think that the English are starving. Now, the plain fact is that the ordinary average person in England is better fed at this moment than he's ever been before in the whole of English history.
Well, Lord Russell, I just got back from England, and I'd say that the people at the top aren't as well fed in England today as the people at our bottom, though.
Well, I dare say that's true, but the people at the bottom are very much better fed than the people at the bottom used to be.
Dr. Alexander.
You said a moment ago that the whole world contributed to our welfare. Don't you really think, Lord Russell, that it's the other way around, that we contribute to the welfare of the whole world?
Well, that too you do, of course, but it isn't altogether that. I mean, during the two wars, you came, I think, through your merits, not through your demerits. You came to be on top. And, of course, it's a great advantage to be on top.
Mr. Cook.
Lord Russell, isn't this little argument about who is better fed and better looking and better generally, hasn't it got a great deal to do with the fact that Britain has to import 60% of its food anyway under any government?
Yes, that's why I say I want the population diminished. I don't think there's any other solution.
Mr. Lindley.
Lord Russell, you cited the fact that a communist could hold a university post in Great Britain as evidence of greater freedom of opinion there. But in your opinion, does a communist, at least one who is a loyal member of the party organization, have the freedom of thought? Is he a proper person to be teaching?
Well, he's a perfectly proper person for certain forms of teaching. You may, for instance, teach crystallography extremely well in spite of being a communist. I don't think that this question of freedom of political thought comes in when you're concerned with crystallography.
Do you think it was foresighted to permit scientists whose devotion to the Soviet Union to get on the inside of our Anglo-American atomic enterprise during the war?
No, that was a mistake, undoubtedly. But I don't think that was a mistake confined to the British.
No.
Lord Russell, in the speech you made at Columbia the other day, you said, no society can be great without great individuals, and I should not think much of a world which had secured universal safety at the price of universal mediocrity. Isn't that the kind of world you're going to end up with if your socialism succeeds?
I think not. I see no reason whatever to suppose it. In the past, 90% of the population, if not more, had no chance to distinguish themselves. Under socialism, everybody would have.
Mr. Reston.
Lord Russell, I wondered if you'd state your opinion as to the different ways in which your country and our country have handled the question of China in the present international political crisis.
Well, I favored the recognition of China at the time when we did it, and I think it's regrettable that you didn't also recognize China. I think China might have been more reasonable if that had been done. And apart from that, I don't think recognition is a reward of merit. After all, both your country and mine recognize the Soviet government, which we don't like. You recognize a government because it's a fact that it's there, not because you like it.
You have stated in the past, I believe, that you thought that the Chinese would be Chinese, no matter what, who they were allied with. Do you see any evidence at the present time that the Beijing regime is breaking away from the Soviet Union?
Not yet, no. I don't see any yet. But I still think that it will happen in time. I think the Chinese are quite powerful enough and large enough to be independent of Moscow if they choose, and I think they will choose in time.
Dr. Alexander.
Do you think that Nye Bevin and his party, who are re-elected, will be a very vigorous obstruction to Churchill's policy, so much so that he won't be able to go ahead without great difficulty?
No, I don't think so. Bevin has managed to get a great deal of publicity, but after all, it's really only a small part of the whole Labour Party that supports him.
Well, he believes in going along with Russia, doesn't he?
No, I don't think so. People always say that about anybody who disagrees with anybody. But I don't think it's true, no. He's less hostile, perhaps, than some other people are. But that's all you can say.
Lord Russell, how do you explain the fact that the Labour government, your Labour government, favoured nationalisation in Great Britain, but didn't particularly like it in Iran?
Oh, I think that answer is extremely simple. In the first place, in Iran, it was the British who put in the capital that made the thing work. And all that the Persians did was to say, now you've done all the work and built up this fine machine, now we'll take it over without compensation, which is not a proper thing to do. In the second place, it was a breach of treaty. And in the third place, as a matter of principle, I don't think you can say that any little country that happens to have oil has a right to that oil. I think that's impossible.
Short question, Miss Lindley.
If you knew that one out of the many books you've written on different subjects would survive 100 years from now, which one would you like it to be and which one would you expect it to be?
Well, those are quite different questions. I should like it to be Principia Mathematica, of which I only wrote half. That's what I should like it to be. I don't know that I should expect it to be any at all. I think in 100 years... the world would be so different, they won't read the books of our time.
Will they read any of your books?
No.
You think not? Mr. Lindley, have you another question?
Out of the changes of opinion that you've undoubtedly undergone in your mature life, can you look back and say there was any one which was most important?
Sorry, I can't let you answer that question. Our time is up.
Yeah.
This concludes the latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Lord Russell, for being with us. And now a word about next week's guest.